Let's talk about practical first. For those of you who had not heard yet, there is going to be a series of interviews for a new chemistry full-time faculty position on the 23rd, which is our last day of class, both for lab and lecture. That entire day is going to end up being canceled because we are going to be in interviews all day. As I had indicated to some of you at least, that is going to mean that the lab quiz that was originally scheduled for that day is going to be shifted back. What I had not yet told you is that there may be the possibility that March 13th class may be canceled as well. Once I am certain what time we are meeting, also for these for this interview process, on the 13th, I will announce whether or not class is going to be canceled on that day. It is definite that class is going to be canceled on the 23rd. It is likely that it is going to be canceled on the 13th, which makes a complete mess of the schedule for the quiz, the lab quiz, and the exam. So I will be sending a message at some point once I am certain what the schedule for the 13th is going to be. I did not see any confirmation yet this morning, so that's why I'm not able to tell you yet right now. But once I am sure, then I will be sure to broadcast the date for the next quiz, which will not be Monday for sure. Monday there is a quiz scheduled, but everything has been off by a day since I've been sick so far. So yes, the quiz is also going to be delayed at least until Wednesday instead of Monday. But once I have confirmation of the interview schedule, then the quiz, the lab quiz, and the exam date I will confirm. The final is not going to change. There would be a sub in here sitting in here giving you the final. So the final is not going to change. Sorry.
Wait, you're not
going to
be here for the final?
No, I say if I wasn't. I am going to be here. But even if something prevented me from being here at the final, even if it's my last dying breath, I would make sure that someone is here to give the final to you. Don't say I never cared. Now, although this may not be pleasant, because we're going to be coming up to the end of the quarter very quickly, because I'm potentially going to be short 2 days in lecture, then I would like to go ahead and go over the answers to the exam that you all just took while that information is still fresh in your head. This may make some of you feel a little better if you got the answers right. It may make some of you have that sinking feeling if you didn't get the answers right. The only thing I can say is that many of you did very well on exam two, and so even if you didn't do as well in this exam as you might have hoped, there's exam two that's going to be holding you up. There is the curve at the end of the quarter that gets to replace the lowest exam if you do well enough on your final. And if it turns out that I really was off in my estimate of how long or how difficult this exam was, I am willing to consider a curve, but please don't ask me what that would be until I see the grades for the exam yet. I do have to keep that in context, though, because I do have a Chem 12 class that is sweating bullets because the average on their first two exams was a D. Yeah. So if you all are feeling a little bit of pressure, then you need to go talk to those students. But that doesn't mean I won't consider one in here. So I just wanted to have said that because I could tell that people were not as happy leaving the exam this last time as the just previous exam. Let me answer these questions in reverse order. No, I don't think anyone got a zero. So the last question was the concentration cell question. You were told that you had a manganese metal in a manganese 2 nitrate solution that was in both half of the cell. But you were told that in one half the concentration was 0.2 molar, but in the other half the concentration was 1.25 molar. So let's draw the same kind of cell diagram that you've seen over and over again now. One question I did not ask, and I'm warning you now, I will likely ask it on the final, is what is the purpose of the salt bridge? And I didn't ask that question on the exam because even though it's probably all over the place in that chapter, I only mentioned it once, I think, during lab when we first learned about electrochemistry. I won't talk about the salt bridge now. Maybe I'll do that as we do our review at some point. But just in case you hadn't read about the salt bridge, I'm telling you, I'm going to be asking about it on the final. So here is our cell. We have manganese for both of the electrodes. We have manganese to nitrate as the solution in both cases. But one side, as I said, was 0.20 molar. The other side was 1.25 molar. First question is, state which solutions electrons will flow towards and explain your reasoning. No, I said that I'm doing this in reverse order. So number 6. Last question on the exam. They're going to flow from the less concentrated solution to the more concentrated solution. Why? Because even if we didn't think of this as an electrochemical cell, if all we went off was the fact that the ion concentrations want to become equal, then that means that the ion concentration on the left has to go up and the ion concentration on the right has to go down. The only way that the concentration can go down on the right is if we have that ion reacting with the electrons to become the metal. So in other words, if reduction occurs on the right-hand side. And then on the left-hand side, the way that the concentration would be increasing is if that solid lost 2 electrons. You were given this particular half reaction up here that manganese plus 2 electrons makes manganese metal with a standard reduction potential of negative 1.18 volts. That doesn't matter for yet to decide which way the electron flow is going to go. But that is going to be the flow of electrons in the system. Then you were asked to calculate the potential of the cell, which I did during the exam cross out the little zero sign because that would have been too simple a problem. In this system, for the whole cell, not just for the reduction potential, what is going to be that voltage? Zero. Why? Because you have the same reaction going in the forward and reverse direction. So what's going to be the voltage here? It's going to be zero minus RT over NF times natural log of Q. Notice that even though this reduction potential is negative, it doesn't show up in the equation here. It's only based on the equilibrium constant. Is that what some of you are discussing out there right now? Okay. That's not fair, but it is what the equation's going to give you. So I don't want to take the time to look up the values of the constants and substitute them here, but I do want to let you know that Q in this case is going to be what? Well, if the concentrations are going to end up trying to equal each other, then it is the solution that is generating ions that's going to be the product. So right now, the product concentration is only 0.2 molar. And then the reactant, that's the side where the electrons are flowing to, that's going to be 1.25 molar. N in this case is going to be equal to 2 because it's a 2-electron process. So presuming that you typed in the right numbers for R, which was given to you, T, which was given to you, and then F, that was also given to you, you should get the right voltage. The standard cell is going to be zero, though, because they're both the same. And in one sense, you could think that there's both reduction and oxidation going on, but the driving force here is to come to the same concentration. Yes. But realize you're getting oxidation and reduction at the same time. That's why I'm saying it's the drive to balance out the concentrations in this case. think about that one. Let's move on to the next one for the moment, and we can come back to this one if we would like to. The next one, backing up, was talking about an electrochemical cell at the standard state and then what would happen if you change the concentrations in that system. So it says, imagine that you have a spontaneous electrochemical cell that is in its standard state. You're asked to draw a reaction progress diagram. That's exactly the type of diagram that I had drawn in lecture to discuss this topic, where you're supposed to go from 100% reactants to 100% products. In this case, because it's a spontaneous reaction, we are going to get a curve that looks like this. We're going to go from high energy to low energy. Our y-axis will be energy, technically in the terms of delta G. Let's see what else it asks you to put on here. 100% reactants to products. Label the point on the diagram corresponding to the reaction at equilibrium. That's the lowest point here. And then it says, label the point on the diagram corresponding to the reaction at the standard state. Well, since the standard state is spontaneous, that means it's higher up in energy. And so I don't know what you might have called this, but one thing you could have labeled it as is Q equals 1. Because by definition, Q always equals 1 at the standard state. So one point that's up further on the curve here, one point that is here down at equilibrium. So it says, using this diagram, explain why the voltage of the cell will be equal to zero at equilibrium. Well, one of the definitions of equilibrium is that there's no observable change in the energy of the system because you're at that lowest possible point. So if you're already at the lowest energy point, there's nowhere lower to go, which that means there's no voltage, there's no potential. The next part is, imagine that in the half of the electrochemical cell where reduction is occurring, if this concentration of the solution is suddenly doubled. Using the diagram you drew, explain whether this doubling of concentration will cause the cell potential to be greater than, equal to, or less than the standard potential. So let's use the... I know I didn't give you a specific reaction that this was related to, but we could choose the copper-silver example that we had done a couple of times in class. Let me try to whip out this cell really quickly here. And remember, in that example, try to give you a picture of it. I had talked about how, as a little demonstration for kids, you could take a solution of silver nitrate, throw a copper penny into it, and it'll look like the penny is starting to grow silver. That is that's a way to just remember in this case that copper is going to be what ends up getting oxidized, that silver is going to end up being what gets reduced. Since I've always been putting the oxidation on the left and the reduction on the right, that means I'm going to have silver as my electrode on the right, copper as my electrode on the left, electron flow going towards the silver. We could, for example, have copper nitrate in the copper as the solution that the copper is in, and then we could have silver nitrate as the solution that the silver is in. Reduction is going to happen on the right-hand side here in this particular case, and so it's saying what would happen if the solution concentration doubles where you have reduction. Remember that reduction means that it's taking in electrons. And so that means that this is a reactant. So what the question said in an indirect way is, what happens if you increase the concentration of reactants? Well, that means that you make the solution look more like reactants. One way to say that is Q is going to be greater than 1 because it's, less. Position on the graph's right. My brain didn't work right. Less than 1, because a Q is products over reactants. So if we're increasing reactant concentration, that means we're decreasing Q. So that means that we're further away from equilibrium than we used to be, which means we're higher in energy, so it's increased voltage. Yes.
I'm sorry. So it's asking about where reduction is occurring.
Yes.
So
Because in any spontaneous cell, the ion that's getting reduced is always the reactant. I chose silver and copper so you had something to look at, but it doesn't matter what the pair is. Whatever the pair is, the one electrode that is going to get oxidized, that produces the ions. Wherever reduction is occurring, it's consuming the ions. And so that means the ions are always the reactant where reduction's occurring. Yeah?
For part B, you said that the reaction is balanced, and so that gives you an LN1, which is zero value.
I mean, there's another creative way you could have done this, which is to say that delta G is equal to negative R, NFE, and then you could have said that delta G is equal to delta G naught plus RT ln of Q. If you said that Q equals K, then what you get is delta G is equal to zero. And if delta G is equal to zero, that means E is equal to zero. So instead of doing it conceptually, you could have done it mathematically. I'm guessing more people did it conceptually, but that's just me guessing, not having looked yet. Yes? That's what I had said the first time. So putting that label delta G equals zero is putting a little bit of math with the concept. But yes, when you're at equilibrium, delta G is zero. That's one of the definitions of equilibrium. So if you said because we're at equilibrium, it's delta G equals zero, that's fine. And then if you said because delta G is zero, there's no voltage, well, that's correct. Other questions about this problem? The voltage will go up.
Oh, okay. So it's not zero?
It's, well, it wasn't zero to start with because I said this was a spontaneous cell.
Okay.
Yeah, this was probably the more elegant and frustrating problem because it made you have to think about the concepts a bit. But that's why I put this problem on here. If it didn't go well as far as you taking it, then it's at least a good learning tool for you then to increase your score on the final. Shall we back up one problem then? The problem before is, oh, another interesting concept one, but I hope this one was easier for you because it wasn't meant to be too tricky. When nickel metal is placed in a solution of aluminum nitrate, nothing happens. When aluminum metal is placed in a solution of nickel nitrate, the solution changes color. Okay? Let's take that one more time. When nickel is placed in aluminum nitrate, nothing happens. What does that mean? That means nickel will not be oxidized and the aluminum will not be reduced. So what does the next thing say? When aluminum metal is put into the nickel nitrate, something happens. So in other words, aluminum is going to react. That's what this is telling you. It's also telling you that the nickel nitrate is therefore going to be reduced. It doesn't say that in so many words, but that's why a reaction would occur. Ah. So what does that mean? That means we could create our electrochemical cell based on that result. Compare it again to what silver and copper do. I had said that if you take copper and put it into silver nitrate, you get a reaction. This is the same problem. If I put aluminum in nickel nitrate, I get a reaction. That means that aluminum is the anode. Because, same electrochemical cell picture, it's telling you that aluminum is going to react, and the only thing it does when it reacts is to lose electrons. And then, what are we doing? Nickel. Nickel is going to be this electrode where reduction is occurring, which means nickel is going to form. So, it says, imagine an electrochemical cell is created. in which one half has the nickel and nickel nitrate, just like I got drawn here, aluminum and aluminum nitrate. Based on the observation of reactivity, state whether aluminum or nickel will be the cathode, and explain your reasoning. Well, the cathode is where reduction is occurring, which means nickel is the cathode. How did I know that? Because nickel is what is coming back out of solution when I put aluminum metal in it. If I go back to the first thing that said, it says when nickel is placed in a solution of aluminum nitrate, nothing happens. What that means is that nickel is worse at being oxidized than aluminum is. That means nickel is better at being reduced than aluminum is, which is what's happening over here. I've actually said the same answer a couple of different ways, but that's the point of the problem. There's a number of different ways you can think of this. Does anyone have any questions about this problem, though? All right. Let's back up to the simpler problems. One here was about standard reduction potentials. So it says the standard reduction potential of a particular reaction is usually measured in an electrochemical cell in which one half of the cell contains the reaction being measured and the other half is the standard electrode. It asks you to describe the standard electrode and state the value of the standard reduction potential for this electrode. Well, it's zero. Because by definition, the standard electrode is zero. The standard electrode is platinum, hydrogen gas, and one molar H plus solution, where you have a oxidation or reduction, oxidation either of hydrogen gas or reduction of the H plus, depending on which way the reaction goes. So I probably had drawn something kind of like this before, where you have platinum wire, you have some kind of container into which you're pumping hydrogen gas, and then you have a solution that's got one molar H plus in it. Now, I didn't ask in this question why was this particular voltage chosen, but remember in lecture I said that one of the reasons it was chosen is because it's right roughly in the middle of the extreme ranges of the reduction potentials. Another reason, when we come back to electrolysis and finally finish it off, is that we have to look at whether H plus might react if we're pumping electricity into an aqueous solution. So that wasn't part of the question, though. It was just asking what is the standard electrode, and that's what it is. And by definition, the standard electrode has a voltage of zero. So it says then, standard cell potentials, including reduction potentials, are always measured at the standard state. Describe all the physical conditions that are true of the standard state, the same ones we had been rattling off in lecture. 1 bar of pressure, 25 degrees Celsius, and then 1 molar concentration of ions. It's that last one that really matters. Then it gives you a question about reduction potentials. It says that for cadmium 2 and for nickel 2, the reduction potentials are negative 0.4 volts and negative 0.25 volts. So nickel plus 2 was negative 0.4 volts. And, oh no, got that backwards. Cadmium was. Nickel was negative 0.25 volts. Says, state which ion is the better oxidizing reagent and explain your choice. Okay, so a negative voltage, is that favorable or not? No. So neither of these like to get reduced, do they? Okay, so what is an oxidizing agent, though? Something that gets reduced. So the question is asking which one of these is the better oxidizing agent. And so the question also means which one's better at getting reduced. So let me write that down. Which is the better oxidizing agent is the same thing as which is better at getting reduced. Now, neither of these, compared to the standard electrode, are good at being reduced. But what if you have something that's even worse? Well, then you might get some kind of reaction that is going to occur. So, which one of these has the less bad voltage? Nickel, which is why nickel is the better oxidizing agent. Because it's higher. So neither are good relative to zero, but this one's better than the other. So even though neither of these ions has a positive reduction potential, the potential for nickel is higher, and so it's the better oxidizing agent. Okay, then for the last part here, it gives you an equation. It says that gold nitrate is going to react with copper to form copper nitrate. What the super duper observant in here might have realized is in the equation there is a tiny error which does not change the answer at all. Let me show you where the error was. It was that I, on my screen even, didn't see that I had typed 3 instead of 2 because it was small, and I didn't catch it till after I printed the exam out. There is no copper 3 nitrate. It's supposed to be copper 2 nitrate. But it didn't matter. Why? Well, let's see what the question's asking. It says, imagine an electrochemical cell is made out of this to take advantage of this reaction. You're told that this is a spontaneous reaction, so you know it's got to work this way. The voltages that you are given are that gold plus 3 being reduced is a positive voltage of 1.5 volts. For the copper 1, which this threw you off in the exam, a few of you, but this was not a mistake. There is a reduction potential for copper 1 instead of copper 2. Doesn't always have to start as copper 2, so that part's not an error. That voltage is plus 0.52 volts. So you can't have both of these reactions occur because you can't have both reductions occurring. One has to be reduction, one has to be oxidation. Well, which one's better at getting reduced? Gold, because gold has the higher voltage. Same question that came up here. Actually, 3 of these questions on the exam really are the same question, just asked from different perspectives. One case I gave you solutions and you had to figure out from the solution reacting which is the oxidizing agent. In this question, I'm giving you voltages. You don't have to guess, but it's still the same type of thing. Where if you compare, we see that one of these is better at being reduced. Gold is the better oxidizing agent. And so that means copper is going to have to flip its reaction around. So copper, if we flip it around to make copper plus an electron, we get negative 0.52 volts. Now, the number of electrons don't balance out. So, and in fact, oh, this is even a triple mistake. I made a mistake in lecture here because if I really want copper 1 to be the nitrate that I'm talking about, then there shouldn't even be a parenthesis there. But it doesn't matter. I could multiply this by 2 or 3 or 50,000 if I had it to get the right number of electrons. What's it going to do to the voltage? Nothing. That's why it didn't matter that I made the mistake, because it won't change the voltage. The voltage is going to be 0.98 volts no matter what. And that was the main part of the question. One, did you know to flip copper around in the first place? Two, did you know that stoichiometry did not matter? Yes. If you didn't balance the equation, you didn't have to. Notice the question did not ask you to balance the equation. As I wanted you to fall into the trap of trying to balance it, multiplying by the voltage, and then that not being correct. Hey, it's not a trick question, though, is it? You need to know it. That's right. All right, backing up to question one. That's probably going to be the easiest one for us all. That is the balance the equation in basic conditions question. Although, because it is simpler, if you don't mind that I could do that the next lecture, so I can at least do a little bit of the new material that I was going to do. Okay. What I wanted to do is, and I don't know if I'm going to get it done in time. I've only got 20-ish minutes to do it. A review of electron configurations and quantum numbers. You might think, well, why? Because we're about to get to coordination complexes, and if you've read ahead, you know that we have to talk a lot about d orbitals and splitting. And not only that, but how the energies of d orbitals change depending on the environment around transition metals. So here's the snapshot of what's coming next in coordination chemistry. It's going to be all about transition metals, and the fact that there are a number of different small molecules that can connect to transition metals to form these large ions that we call transition metal complexes. The ions that can attach to the transition metals sometimes will attach only once. Sometimes the same molecule can connect in two different points or four points. There's even an example of a molecule that you have in that chapter that connects at six different points and kind of surrounds the metal. These small molecules that can interact with the metal are what are known as ligands. And they're sometimes irreversibly attached. They'll make a tight complex with it. Sometimes they can reversibly attach. I've brought this example up in different ways in lab, but a classic example of a transition metal complex is in hemoglobin. The iron center, which is responsible for transporting oxygen through the body. So that's just one example of a complex. There are many types of complexes, each with their own geometry. Again, if you've already read through the chapter, you know that sometimes these transition metal complexes will form square planar geometry. Sometimes they'll form tetrahedral geometry. And one of the more common ones that we find is what's called octahedral geometry. Octahedral, if you can remember the shape from Vesper theory, is where you have six things that are equally spaced around a central atom. So in these transition metal complexes, if you have six, let's say, different molecules, each attaching just once each in these six different directions, that shape is called octahedral. Well, here's the point of us doing a little bit of review. Imagine that each one of these ligands has got lone pairs or charges that it's using to bond to the central transition metal. So as a negative charge comes towards this central atom, you know, it can repel with the electrons that are already on that metal. Even though there might subsequently bond somehow, there's still some interaction that might occur. So that can cause the energy of the electrons already on that metal to raise up a little bit. But those different ligands coming from different directions, they're going to interact with the orbitals on that metal in slightly different ways because the orbitals have different shapes. So if, for example, an orbital is sticking exactly in the same direction that one of these ligands is coming in, there's going to be a much greater interaction that occurs there, an unfavorable interaction because like charges are interacting. That's versus if you have an orbital on that metal that has nothing to do with the ligand that's coming in, then there's not going to be as much interaction. But what that's going to mean is that if we had looked at the ion itself, the d orbitals there, they're going to all initially be the same energy. But once we allow these ligands to surround the metal, they're going to split the energy. Why does that matter? because that's what's responsible for the color in many of these transition metal complexes. If you look at the lower energy orbital where there might be electrons available and a higher energy orbital that might be missing electrons, well, that transition back and forth between those two energy levels is the transition that is responsible in most cases or many cases for the color that we observe in transition metals. So what we're going to be doing is talking about transition metals, and we need to then do some of the nitty-gritty work of talking about electron configurations. From there, we'll then talking about the shapes that of these transition metal complexes that we can form. We'll then talk about how that affects the orbitals energy levels, and most importantly, how that causes splitting in the energy levels, and then we'll relate that to the color of transition metal complexes. Along the way, then we'll also have to talk about the different types of ligands. As I had mentioned earlier, there's the ligands that can attach just once. Those are known as monodentate. Dentate being related to a root word for tooth, think dental. So monodentate is one tooth, one connection to that metal. Bidentate, two. Polydentate, many. And then there's another term for those polydentate ligands, which is related to the word for claw. Imagine a claw clamping down on a metal ion. Those are called chelates. So lots of little bits of things that we need to talk about, but before we can get into it, that's all in chapter 23. How many of you read chapter 23? That's why even the A-plus students are kind of going, oh my gosh, we got some reading to do this weekend, right? I hope the message that you're getting from this, because if what I just said didn't make any sense, that's why you got to go read chapter 23. But we need a little bit of review. So how am I going to do quantum mechanics in 10 minutes? What is a wave function? Let me demonstrate the closest real-world equivalent that I can come up with the equipment I have available. This, in fact, here. So you can see what I'm doing. The lonely phone cord. What is happening with the phone cord right now? Any observable, regular, repetitive pattern? No, because I'm wiggling it with some unspecified amount of energy, but not enough to cause anything to happen in the system, right? Nothing interesting happens until I get to a certain minimum energy level. Once I'm there, I barely have to do anything because I've hit a particular, you could say, resonant frequency for the system. Notice that it's not a perfect system. I do have to move this to get the wave to go. But ideally, if this was, for example, a string vibrating, this end wouldn't be moving and that end wouldn't be moving. And so those are two fixed endpoints that determine exactly what the frequency that would be ideal for this wave to have based on the tension of the cord, what the cord is made of. But in other words, there's some physical parameter of the system that says here's what the wave should look like. If I try to put more energy to try to increase the frequency, well, that ends up not working. Because, for example, if you have a wave that's increasing in frequency, that means that its wavelength is shrinking. Well, that means the end point would be somewhere in space here, not where the end of the phone cord is. What that means is if I add more energy, the wave starts disappearing because it can't exist because it's not quite the right frequency for these boundary conditions until I increase my energy enough where all of a sudden a new wave is created. This new wave still has the same two end points, but it also has a new, what looks like, fixed point in the middle. What is that point called? It's called a node. That's right. If I decrease in energy again, then the wave disappears. It's chaotic until I lower the energy enough where all of a sudden out pops that lowest energy wave again. So here's the lowest energy wave. I put some more energy in it until I get to the right packet of energy, the right quantum of energy, then I can get to the next wave. I put some more energy into it, and I can get it where? There we go. Where it looks like it has two fixed endpoints to it. What is the point of this? Electrons are waves in the same way. There's experiments we can do that demonstrate the electron or the wave behavior of electrons and the particle behavior of light. Photoelectric effect, for example, is a demonstration of the particle nature of light. Electron diffraction, where we're using electrons like waves, that's evidence that electrons have wave behavior. So this wave function tells us what an atom is doing. There are a certain number of packets of energy available to that atom. And there's some lowest energy level, just like I showed you on that phone cord over there. So in the lowest energy level, there are zero nodes, for example. Go one energy level up, there's one node. Go one energy, energy level up, two nodes. Three, four, five, six, so on and so forth. What's the point? Well, to give you an example, what's this letter L? Number of energy packets oriented spherically. Its real name is orbital angular momentum. But because most of you haven't had physics, I don't think, you would have no idea what this means. Imagine then the whole orbital, the whole space that that electron exists in, is in some way rotating around the nucleus, going around and around in a circle. Well, that circle has certain physical constraints, just like the phone cord did when it was wiggling. In the same way, then, electrons have very rigid constraints as far as the possible waves they can exist as. And when L equals zero, what that means is zero nodes, spherically. Well, if you have a sphere that has zero nodes, then you just have a sphere. What if L equals one? Well, that means one node. So if I cut a sphere in half, what does that look like? Well, if I then go up to L equals two, two nodes. Two nodes that mathematically have to be orthogonal to each other somehow. That generates this shape. Of course, we recognize these shapes as the S, P, and D orbitals, which are nothing more than the first, second, and third energy levels of spherical motion around an atom, which you probably haven't heard it expressed that way before, but that's exactly what it is. That's L. I skipped over N. What is N? Total number of packets of energy available to an electron. One of those packets is always used just to keep it from the nucleus. You know, there is nothing lower than the N equals 1 level because just like for that phone cord example, there was a lowest energy level possible there. And below that, it was just chaos. To oversimplify, the same thing happens with an electron. It just can't drop below that lowest energy level because there's no division of energy small enough that that electron is able to lose because electrons can only have energy in specific packets of energy. By the way, before you all start getting worried, none of this is on the quiz. This is the review that we need to talk about electron configurations, and it's related, and we'll get there. But hold on for another minute, because N minus 1 is the total packets. I can't spell my packets usable by the electron. Because one packet is taken up just keeping it from crashing into the nucleus. So then there's N minus 1 packets left over. Where have you seen that N minus 1 value before? Maximum value of L. So here's the answer to the question, why is there no such thing as a 1p orbital? Because the shape p requires one packet of energy. When you're at the n equals 1 energy level, which is what you're at the first row of the periodic table, there aren't any more packets available for that electron to do anything with. So it does not have the energy available to become a p orbital. The only thing possible at the n equals 1 level is an s orbital. Now, if you bump up to the n equals 2 level, then you have one extra packet of energy available, which you can do one of two things with. Send it around the nucleus, which is why you end up with a p orbital. Or you could have a 2s orbital, which if you look at the real shape of a 2s orbital, it's something like this. It's not a sphere. It's a sphere within a sphere, where that boundary is a spherically shaped node. That's because if you have spherical nodes, they're linear, but if you have linear nodes, they're spherical. And if that's a brain scrambler, well, that's why it's quantum mechanics. Even the Nobel Prize winning people in quantum mechanics say you never really understand quantum mechanics, you just get used to it. Because there are no physical examples for any of this. It's all stuff on paper in your heads and multidimensional systems. And yes. So how is this related to electron configurations? Because we can use the quantum numbers to figure out what orbitals are possible. There's a 1s, there's a 2s, a 2p, 3s, 3p, 3d, 4s, blah, 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 blah. But they don't occur in order, do they? No. So there are what are known as shielding and penetration. And since this is not 1A, since I have to just do the short version, I can summarize the point of this. These are effects that occur in polyelectronic systems. That cause the energy levels of orbitals to occur out of order, you could say. Where it's not just all the n equals 1, or the n equals 2, and then the 3, and then the 4. No, they're out of order. What can we use to predict what that order is going to be? Periodic table. Why? Because the elements of the periodic table are arranged according to what? Atomic number, which is what? Z, which is what? Number of protons. What is the number of electrons equal to in any neutral element? Number of protons. So if the periodic table is arranged according to how many protons there are, indirectly it's already automatically arranged as far as how many electrons there are. So if we want to know how electron filling occurs, just look at the periodic table. When you have just two electrons, you get the first row of the periodic table, you just fill up that 1s orbital, that's it. On the left-hand side, the next thing to fill is lithium. Why are there only two elements in that block of the periodic table, two independent columns? Because those are where the s orbitals are getting filled. And there's only one s orbital in any level, and that's why there's only two columns on the periodic table there. What's the next thing to fill up? P orbitals. And there are three p orbitals at any energy level, which is why there's six columns on the periodic table, because each orbital can hold two electrons. And then in the middle between the 2 and the 6, what are known as the S and the P blocks, we have the transition metals. And there's 10 columns there because they're related to the D orbitals. So we can use the periodic table to come up with the standard pattern of 1S, 2S, 2P, 3S. I guess I should put these numbers in too. 1S2, 2S2, 2P6, 3S2, 3P6, 4S2, 3D10. Notice that the 4 and the 3 are out of order. It's because of this shielding and penetration. I got us to where we got a general pattern for an electron configuration. We're going to start here on Monday.